Welcome to episode 216 of Troubadours and Raconteurs, with yours truly, E.W. Conundrum Demure. On this week's program, we have as a special guest, writer, editor, professor, Dr. Robert Mooney. And we talk with Dr. Mooney about his newest novel. We talk to him about the process of creative writing, how he found it, what it means to him. Also, we talk about radical empathy and reading recklessly, about finding the truth in fiction, and so many other interesting aspects of being a thinker, being a reader, being a human in this time, in this place. We also have a very exceptional essay shared, written, and read by our very own Dr. Michael Pavese, a.k.a. Uncle Cesare, titled An Ode to Topo Gigio. We have an EW essay by yours truly called Sunlight and Darkness, and a poem by William Butler Yeats titled Politics. And of course, as is always the case, we also share with you several great tunes. It's nice to have you with us. Let's get to it. Episode 216 of Troubadours and Raconteurs.
I'm sick and tired of hearing things from uptight, short-sighted, narrow-minded hypocrites. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth. I've had enough of reading things by neurotic, psychotic, pig-headed politicians. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth. No short-head, yellow-bellied son of Tricky Dick is gonna mother her, but top so meager, just a pocket full of hope. Money for dough, money for road.
sunlight and darkness. Nothing really matters anymore with regard to my personal stead, given the reality that in many people causes deep dread. It won't be long, relatively speaking, before I will be gone, out of here, dead. All that matters now are the existential questions and challenges looming incessant within my heart, head, and soul. What sort of legacy, what sort of change can this one meager man contribute? Maybe instead I should withdraw more complete, smoke another bowl, drink another beer, and steer clear of incessant, pointless wanderings of my species. Go clean up the erratically positioned dog feces in the backyard, as the sunlight is all that I can find the truth in. How pragmatically dour to have become so sour on the essence of this life. Ooh yeah, life goes on long after the thrill of living is gone. Mr. Mellencamp, I couldn't make sense of that sentiment when I was a younger man. Now I can. The sunlight and darkness are all we could be certain of. Not the devil, not the dove. Perhaps, maybe, if it truly exists, then too we can believe in the power of courageous love. But nothing really matters anymore with regard to my personal stead, given the reality that... Wait, can't I have a turn to even the score? The existential questions, challenges. Cowgirl in the sand, Mr. Young, old enough now to change your name. Can this one meager man contribute? The song remains the same.
Surfing. Hello?
Hello, Robert Mooney. Is this you?
Yes, is this Lawrence?
Yes, yes. CW Conundrum from Troubadours and Rock on Tours. Nice to have you on
it
the program.
And thank you very much. Am I coming in all right?
Oh, you sound clear. Clear.
Okay, good.
Yeah. Let me start off our conversation, if you don't mind, by giving our listeners some background, and then we'll get in. I have some questions for you.
Great.
Okay, here we go. Robert Mooney is a story writer, short stories, novelist as well, and he's an editor, a professor. His most recent publication is a novel titled Father of the Man. He has published numerous short stories, including Halloween in the Patterson Library Review, which was nominated for the Pushcart Prize, the Artful Dodger. I'm thinking of another writer.
Full of the Dickens.
Yeah, full of the Dickens. MSS and Timbuktu, Esquires. And also, Mooney has a background, formally educated at Boston College, where he earned his BA, an MA, and a PhD from Binghamton University. He later went on to serve as director of the creative writing program at Binghamton University from 1987 to 1997, where he also served as assistant editor of MSS, the literary magazine founded by the American novelist John Gardner, and later founded and served as senior editor of New Myths Press, publishing the work of some of the finest writers in the country. He is co-founder and executive editor at Etruscan Press, and associate professor of English and creative writing at Washington College, where he directed the O'Neill Literary House and Creative Writing Program from 1997 to 2005. He recently joined the honorary board of, or at Narrative 4, a global writing initiative begun by novelist Colm McCann, the mission of which involves the incitement of, quote, radical empathy among people of all cultures. Ladies and gentlemen, it's good to have on Troubadours and Rock on Tours, Robert Mooney.
And thank you very much for having me. Boy, you read those chapters of my resume, it makes me sound good, but I'm sitting here taking notes myself. It's all true, and it's been a delightful ride. And I understand that you're interested in the creative writing process and publishing and books yourselves.
Yeah, I am, very much so. My associate producer and good friend, Dr. Michael Pavese, he's a big fan of yours. He appreciates all you've done in your career so far.
And Mike's great. Yeah, you've got a good colleague there. I remember Mike vividly from back in the days of Binghamton.
Yeah, he also earned his education, his doctorate up there at Binghamton. I guess it's a place where say impressive minds go.
Well, you know, at that particular time, it was very rich with I think some really good and ambitious young writers, people who were flocking there. Part of the draw, at least for me, was, as you mentioned, John Gardner was there, and at the time he was one of the best known novelists in the country at the time, and had a reputation as being a really hands-on teacher, somebody who was dedicated to mentoring young writers into the literary conversation. So we had a lot of really good and interesting and earnest people there who were investigating, their place in the writing life. And Mike was certainly one of them. Another, you had mentioned my association with Wilkes University. Another graduate student at the time was Bonnie Culver, who began the MFA MA program at Wilkes, low residency. About a dozen years or so ago, and she called on some of us who had run programs, as I had, and my partner at Etruscan Press, Phil Brady, to sort of help her design a program that would be unique and effective for young writers. So, those associations from back in those Binghamton days continue on, and we continue trying to do what we can in the literary life and in the world of letters.
Yeah, let's get into that, doing what you can. I mean, writing, how important is it? And mainly you're a creative writer.
Yes.
So fiction, I suppose. Would that be fair?
Yes. In addition to the novel that you mentioned, I've got one that I've just recently sent out, set in Pennsylvania and southern New York, in fact, and another set in Ireland. So I've remained active on the page with novels that, for me at least, tend to take me about 6 or 7 years to pen. I'm primarily engaged in writing fiction and in editing fiction at Etruscan, and of course teaching creative writing at Washington College in Wilkes.
Well, when did you realize, and how do you think you came about the notion that creative writing was a direction for you?
That's a good question. I think when I was young, I didn't know that I knew that. Just in the way that I would engage with pages, whenever something happened that was hard for me to figure out as a kid, I can remember at 9, 10, 11, I would try to work it out with language, on paper. I can remember, my father was a lawyer, and he used to have his shirts dry cleaned, and at least in the old days, there'd be this thin white piece of cardboard, to keep the shirt, unwrinkled. And I used to take those from his dry cleaning, and I would fill them with words, and most of it was just trying to map my way out of trouble, or confusion. I didn't connect that to any, future field of study or ambition to be a writer. It was just my relationship with language and having some sort of dialogue with myself to try to figure things out, which essentially is how I see my engagement with fiction, creating believable characters and realistic situations, and trying to find, what's right, what's best, what's true, and dealing with things in that way, drawing from life and creating, shaping it in language. It's just a way of thinking about the world, I suppose, and for me, it works.
So trying to find the truth through fiction, even as a child, those early stories that you scribbled on the cardboard from the dry cleaners, were you imagining scenarios, or were you wrestling more with the reality you were trying to understand?
I was wrestling with the reality I was trying to understand, but of course, in doing that, I was writing fiction insofar as, our way of thinking, insofar as it includes memory, is partly fictional. When we remember something that happened, as I just did with the cardboard out of the dry cleaning, that's a memory and it happened. But the way that I told it is sort of it introduces a kind of fiction. When we shape the chaos of time into sense, there's some sense of fictionalizing. In fact, the root of the word fiction, the etymology, if you follow it back in time, it simply means to shape. And trying to shape sense out of something in language is always going to be in part fictional.
I like that. And as you started to, I guess, realize your love of words and how they gave you a release to some extent, you probably started reading a lot. And I'm wondering some of the early writers that influenced you, and up to today even.
Oh, yeah, absolutely, yeah. I mean, the attraction to language was on the page in other people's hands. For sure, and you're right. I mean, writing is a release, but the kinds of writers that I found myself most interested in were doing writing that I wanted to try to do, which would be, and I wouldn't have put it like this at the time, to engage rather than to sort of look away or get a break from reality, but to engage it in a deeper sense. you know, whether it's figuring out, you know, why Sally didn't like me in third grade to, you know, was that thing that I said to that person that hurt him? Why did it hurt him? What did I say? How does interrelationship work here? I would read. In fact, found myself most attracted at a young age to writers like Faulkner, who I remember reading his book Intruder in the Dust when I was 12 or 13 years old, and I had no idea when I finished that novel what happened. But I sensed this kind of thrum in the book that there was something there and that it was essential, and I couldn't understand it. But through the way that the language was arranged, the words that were coming out, the melody, its rhythm in my head, I knew there was something there. And I went back and I remember reading it two or three times, and in bits it came to me, you know, this made sense and that made sense. But I loved the sense that there was something substantial there that I couldn't understand, but if I kept at it, it would come to me and it would be earned and it would be valuable. And so I kind of cut my teeth on some pretty thick stuff early on. I Joyce was another one, reading Ulysses at I was older, but just became enamored of its kind of literary atomic weight, you know, just knowing this is something that I can spend my life going back to, and it'll keep giving to me. And so I found myself attracted to that. John Gardner was somebody that I read early on because he grew up in my mother's hometown in upstate New York, and there was that connection. And then I had an opportunity to apply to Binghamton and work with him. So some things came around full circle there, and we used to have conversations similar to the one that we're having right now. You know, who are you reading? Here's who you should be reading. And it goes on and on. You need to read Beckett. You need to read John Barth. You need to read, Flannery O'Connor and Virginia Woolf. And, you know, one thing leads to another, and you're cultivating this busy inner life through reading.
That sounds wonderful. It's a great, it's almost, as you said, it's something you could go back to and consistently, because of, as you put it, the literary atomic weight, sort of delve into and get more from, and maybe even sort of get you back into a place you've lost, if you are lost. Does that make sense?
Yeah. So what you mean is that you're returning to a place?
Yes.
Through the literature?
Yes, exactly. Like some people might turn to the Quran or to the Bible or the Torah or some other religious sort of steadfast piece of direction. Maybe certain pieces of literature can do the same for folks.
Absolutely, yeah, and you're right about return too. You know, there's that recognition, you know, that recognition to know again, you know, from a different angle or with different characters can help to reinforce some things that we thought we knew and correct things that we thought we knew that in fact we didn't know. You know, and follow truth around time and space. Insofar as it, that it makes us who we are and tempers us and teaches us, and to me, you know, you were saying fiction is kind of untruth or lie that tells the truth, and I love that dichotomy, and yeah. And I think if there's any truth in life, it has to do with the positioning of seeming opposites, you know, like an oxymoron. There's truth in that. That kind of ambiguity that I don't think we get in simplifications that tend to be popular in cultures, because they're more immediately comfortable.
Well put. Well put. Well, I have another question here that I jotted down. What do you think of the prospect of creative writing delving into politics?
Do you mean the process insofar as, like, I'm engaged in it, in the classroom teaching younger folks who you know, want to be writers? Or do you mean, like, publishing authors writing political novels, for example?
The latter.
Oh, okay. Well, that's a real good question. I mean, we live obviously in a huge way a political age. You know, we can't avoid it, and this has been going on for decades. I think of Yeats's poem Politics. You know, he begins with an epigraph by the novelist Thomas Mann, who says that, you know, one of the things about our life that he suggests isn't so good is that we tend to define things and essential parts of our life in terms of politics, and we're kind of trapped in that. I mean, it's like weather, you know. I mean, you can't change it, and we live in it. So fiction writers are going to write about life as they experience it, and I don't know that we can completely, if we try, completely elide or erase, you know, some political threads in whatever kind of story that we write.
Yeah, it's the context, I guess, that you're living in.
We live in a very political context. I mean, can you think of something that hasn't been politicized in our time right now?
Especially in the last month, no.
Well, you know, I mean, we can't talk about the weather without sort of evoking politics.
Right.
You know, it's like, wow, it's February today here in Maryland. It was close to 70 degrees and sunny in February, you know.
Climate
change.
I
mean, mentioning that is politics.
Right. Right, exactly.
You know, so I'm not saying that's a good thing, but I agree with Mon that, you know, it's we're kind of, you know, to a certain extent, we're in our time. We're incarcerated in our time and generation. And, you know, this is a big part of how we're organized and how we think about each other in the world we live in. I'm not saying I'm happy with that.
It's just reality.
I understand. Yeah, I mean, a novel I recently finished is about. It begins with a veteran of the Second Iraq War, who comes back to Pennsylvania, in fact, with PTSD, and he knows that he's diagnosed. Just that premise is kind of a lays a political foundation for the narrative that follows. That isn't interested in who's running for what, but I mean, it's there. And people are going to have thoughts about, you know, Iraq and whether we should have been there or not. And look at what this kid's going through. And then look at how he's treating his wife. And then there's, you know, that's disrespectful or sexist. Yeah, but he has PTSD. So we've got all these currents coming in that have political bearing. And I can't ignore them.
No.
As a writer.
No, that, you would be taking out a lot of the verve, right? A lot of the real substance of your story if you try to avoid them, I'd imagine.
Yeah, well, and then you know there, and I suppose in part you're asking about, you know, there are novelists, some famously who deal with politics head on, you know, from you know, Robert Penn Warren's All the King's Men or. You know, Orwell's famous 1984, you know, or Lord of the Flies, Catch 22, or even sci-fi and Fahrenheit 451, you've got and Gore Vidal's novels. You could even see, you know, the oft-read To Kill a Mockingbird, and then, you know, the sequel that recently came out that was found and published. Those are political novels to a certain extent, yeah, as well, but they're more than that. There are other things going on there too that that are probably more at the heart of their concern. How does the human heart negotiate the world that has this stuff in it?
And that's the artist, I think, right there. You know, in my view, I look at certain people that have an artistic sort of proclivity, and they look at the social situation that they're living in, which is part political, And then they're struggling to understand. And one of the things that you're concerned about that's important to you is empathy, you know, and how do we address these challenges and maybe this injustice, this craziness. I think that an artist really struggles with that, maybe a bit more than people who don't have such a proclivity. Does that sound fair?
But well said. And I think that, you know, you're sort of evoking Colin McCann's terrific project, you know, that he says is really an exercise in radical empathy. McCann and I have talked about this at length. I mean, reading is an exercise in empathy. Writing is kind of an exercise in empathy on steroids, because you have to actively, daily, inhabit characters that you're creating who are not you, and try to negotiate the world intimately as other. You know, I mean, I've never been a 90-year-old woman in Mississippi in the 1960s, but I can try as best I can to inhabit that life and imagine it detail by detail and sort of experience it if I do my homework and I'm true to the realities that character had to deal with and negotiate, and throw a conflict in there and see how she, you know, how the potential of her character is released or not by that. I think that this notion of empathy in story is important to me as a writer, but I would say that it's important to all of us. I mean, what we're seeing in politics now, for example, is really an attempt to control the narrative. You know, the fiction writer wants to tell, lie his or her way to a greater truth than was previously understood. But people can take the narrative project and lie their way to greater lies. And if they can make them believable, they can be very dangerous things. Well, because we live by story. We're moved by story, not by facts.
And
narrative, who shapes the best narrative repeats it most, you know, at the loudest microphone, if it's not true, and it can be dangerous, it's a weapon, and it's something we need to be wary of in this political age that we live in. To be able to tell story, to be able to learn by story is a wonderful thing, but it can be toxic material.
I think you're right on the pulse of what is occurring now politically when you look at the phrases that are thrown around in journalism, such as fake news, or in politics, such as fake news, such as alternative facts. It's all relative, it seems, people are saying. Whatever you believe is true, then that is true. And if people say it enough, as you put it, and loud enough, then that is the narrative.
Yeah, and that's what we have to be very careful of, I think, Lawrence, because, you know, just because a story is repeated by people doesn't verify it. It's only an echo. And what I love and respect about fiction is, you know, you have to prove your case. You know, when I taught a creative writing class one time in Binghamton, and this young writer wrote this story that was outrageous. It was just too coincidental. I said, well, this really stretches belief. It's hard to believe. And, you know, he was ready for me. He pulled out these clips from a newspaper saying, see, it happened. And that was all the validation, you know, he thought he needed. And I said, that's not good enough. And he and his fellow students were stunned. What do you mean it happened? It's reality. I said, yeah, but fiction has to prove its reality. It's got to prove it like an airtight case in order to be believed. Reality doesn't have to prove itself.
Why didn't his fiction prove itself in his piece?
Well, in our trade, we call it verisimilitude. It didn't justify the sequence of events in a way that made them credible.
Even though he was referencing something that actually happened, the way he presented it, the way he constructed it, it didn't justify itself.
And the crafting, and yeah, that's my point. The shaping of the story for, you know, a literary artist is paramount. You need to make it believable, not only in a factual sense, but it has to feel that it's authentic. You know, when in the early sort of modern age, we didn't call novels novels; we called them histories. And if you read like 18th century works, they'll spend the first couple pages often, you know, saying, trying to convince you that this actually happened. And a lot of the narrative is trying to create a case detail by detail of its viability, of its believability. And I think that's what we don't have in the current political scene, that we're too easily, maybe it's because of all our electronic devices and social media, it's too easy to be heard. Nobody's really listening. They're just hearing, you know. Nobody's demanding, you know, believability in the tone and in the use of detail in narratives. And that's dangerous because, as we know, history is pretty fragile. You know, I mean, there are Holocaust deniers. There are people that say that the moon landing was staged. And who can prove that they're wrong, you know, if their story seems reasonable enough? So we've got a responsibility to the truth and to its maintenance, but it's going to constantly be under attack. Fiction writers, I think, should be, and the best are in the front lines of protecting the integrity of story that we live by.
I love it. This is a joy talking with you, sir. I love your insights.
Well, it's an honor to be on your show. I've looked you guys up on the website, and what you've had over 200 folks in, and you know, and you're doing the same thing I am. You're just trying to figure things out and get it right.
Exactly. Thank you for saying that. I appreciate it. We have a couple of more minutes only in our conversation, Robert Mooney, professor, writer, editor, among other things. And do you have any closing thoughts and maybe some information to share with our listeners where they could find out more about your projects, your latest novel and such?
Sure. Well, look at our press. Phil Brady and I and Steve Oristaglio started Truscan Press actually right after 9/11. We published poetry and fiction and biography, creative nonfiction at etruscanpress.org. Get a sense of, you know, the work. We published close to 50 books in that time. You know, with the project, as we've been talking about it, Lawrence, and Colin McCann's Narrative 4, and the importance of telling stories across divides is much better than politics as far as healing our world culture into creative cohesiveness. So look at those, or tap me at Washington College off our website. I'd be happy to answer to any curious truth seeker out there interested in writing. We have a wonderful program down here in Chestertown, Maryland.
And excuse me, any suggestion or thought to help someone who is trying to understand the world through writing? How can they keep at it? How can they better, I guess, achieve that goal?
Yeah, good question. And I'll answer it the way Faulkner, whom I mentioned earlier, answered it. There are three things to do: read, and then read everything. You know, you put the screen away for a while. Weave it into your daily life. Read novels, read poems, read good novels, read bad novels. It's such a good way to get a calibration of the world that we live in. You know, Vonnegut once said about all of us living in the world, he just said, you know, we all just got here. And how do we figure out things? How do we figure out how the world works and who we are? And I have found no better way than reading recklessly towards some sense of what it is.
Beautiful. Robert Mooney, thank you so much for being on Troubadours and Rock on Tours.
Thanks for having me on. It was a pleasure.
Same here, sir. Talk to you soon.
Take care.
Pedro lives out of the Wilshire Hotel. He looks out a window without glass. The walls are made of cardboard. Newspapers on his feet, and his father beats him because he's too tired to beg. He's got 9 brothers and sisters. They're brought up on their knees. It's hard to run when a coat hanger beats you on the thighs. Pedro dreams of being older and killing the old man, but that's a slim chance. He's going to the boulevard. He's gonna end up on the dirty boulevard. He's going out to the dirty boulevard. He's going down to the dirty boulevard. This room costs $2,000 a month. You can believe it, man, it's true. Somewhere a landlord's laughing till he wets his pants. No one dreams of being a doctor or a lawyer or anything. They dream of dealing on the dirty boulevard. Give me your hungry, you're tired, you're poor, I'll piss on them. That's what the statue of bigotry says. Your poor huddled masses, let's club them to death and get it over with and just dump them on the boulevard. Get them out on the dirty boulevard. Going out to the dirty boulevard. They're going down on the dirty boulevard. Going out. It's a bright night. There's an opera at Lincoln Center. Movie stars arrive by limousine. The Klieg lights shoot up over the skyline of Manhattan, but the lights are out on the mean streets. A small kid stands by the Lincoln Tunnel. He's selling plastic roses for a buck. The traffic's backed up to 39th Street. The TV whores are calling the cops out for a suck. And back at the wheelchair, Pedro sits there dreaming. He's found a book on magic in a garbage can. He looks at the pictures and stares up at the cracked ceiling. At the count of 3, he says, I hope I can disappear and fly, fly away from this dirty boulevard. I want to fly, yeah. From the dirty boulevard, I want to fly. From the dirty boulevard, I want to fly, 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 fly. From the dirty boulevard, I wanna fly away. I wanna fly, fly, fly away. Yeah. I wanna fly, fly, fly away.
Fly.
Homage to Topo Gigio. Every Sunday night at 8, Americans gathered in front of their 19-inch Philcos to watch The Ed Sullivan Show. We were no different. We suffered the dodgy and snowy reception, often blamed on the neighbor across the street, a ham radio operator, also, as it happened, named Sullivan. We cursed him. Damn that Sullivan! Picturing him up in his attic, scheming to disrupt our enjoyment of the antics of, say, Danny Kaye. We wanted to wallow in the surfeit of entertainment provided by the wooden, oft-imitated gossip columnist turned MC, turned cultural institution. Ed, as we called him, gave us a cornucopia of culture, high and low. There was culture with a capital C, opera singers like Beverly Sills, and snippets of Nureyev dancing Swan Lake, and jazz and classical musicians performing for an audience larger than years of sold-out concert venues. Victor Borge and Liberace covered musical territory, merging the classic and the comic. There was Broadway, the original Tony and Maria in the fire escape scene from West Side Story. Richard Burton and Julie Andrews singing about the simple folk in Camelot. Richard Kiley emoting like crazy during The Impossible Dream in Man of La Mancha. And Dick Van Dyke cavorting in Put on a Happy Face from Bye Bye Birdie, which includes a song about Ed Sullivan, which was also performed on the show. There were singers and bands galore, everyone from Vic Damone to, of course, the Beatles. From Straight Arrows in Skinny Ties to Stoners in Beads and Fringe. From bouffant haired ladies in gowns to girls in white go-go boots. There were comedy teams, Stiller and Mira, Allen and Rossi, Burns and Schreiber, and comedians, old and borscht-beltish like Jackie Vernon, Jack Carter, Jackie Mason, and young and hip like George Carlin, Richard Pryor, and Woody Allen. It was the heyday of Impressionists, Frank Gorshin, Rich Little, John Byner, and David Fry, who slayed with his William F. Buckley, Lyndon Johnson, and Nixon, and then disappeared into the pop culture void after Nixon's resignation. Ed presented the remains of vaudeville, novelty acts like acrobats in tight-fitting spangly outfits and manic plate spinners, and humiliated monkeys in tiny tuxedos riding bicycles. There were Senior Wences, the bizarre Spanish ventriloquist who had, for dummies, a disembodied head in a black box and his hand painted with lipstick. And then there was Topo Gigio. Topo Gigio was one of the many popular puppets at the time. The earliest versions of the Muppets played Ed Sullivan. Shari Lewis and her sweet lamb chop made the variety and talk show circuit. Waylon Flowers and his campy old lady, Madam, with their racy double entendres, catered to clueless or discerning adults. Kukla, Fran, and Ollie, a bald, arch-browed, and bulbous-nosed puppet, a woman, and a dim-witted one-toothed dragon, had their own children's TV show. And Captain Kangaroo, in addition to Mr. Moose and the always annoying Bunny Rabbit, with his bottomless lust for carrots, presented an assortment of odd creatures, singing and dancing to standards or to original songs, inculcating lessons in hygiene and morality in young viewers. These aged children now drift into senility with visions of the captain's happy critters sailing over cardboard seas. Topo Gigio was in a class by himself, a recurring supporting character on the most popular show on TV. He was an Italian mouse with abandonment issues. He had a whiny, accented voice and a neediness young viewers could identify with. And he was a foreigner, somewhere between Chef Boyardee and Gina Lollobrigida on the exoticism scale. At the end of the show, Ed would chat with Topo, who might be engaged in various self-improvement activities, studying art, for example. Or he might discuss his girlfriend Rosie. And once he brought his whole family on to sing Finiculi, Finicula. After their shtick, Topo would always ask Ed for a goodnight kiss. "Kiss me goodnight, Eddie," Topo would implore the host. With his death mask of a face, and the prunish lips that once spread rumors of Starlet's communist sympathies at Sardi's, the great stone face would bend over and kiss the mouse. Topo giggled, and America's entertainer-in-chief said goodnight to his country. My mother loved the movie stars of Hollywood's golden age, and she passed her passion on to me. She named one son for Robert Taylor, the star of Camille, and a friendly witness at the UAC hearings during the blacklist, and a daughter after Joan Crawford, the self-sacrificing mother in Mildred Pierce, and the notorious mother of Mommy Dearest. She wanted to name a son after Clark Gable, but caved to family pressure and later regretted it. and her pantheon included Cary Grant and Katharine Hepburn and Loretta Young and Jimmy Stewart and John Wayne. I love them all, too, especially the Duke. John Wayne was a go-to actor of the Impressionists on Ed Sullivan, with his distinctive swagger and catchphrases. From an early age, I tried out impressions on my mother, an informed and supportive audience. John Wayne was one of my first impressions, and Topo Gigio was a favorite. At my mother's request, I would always oblige with my take on that needy foam rubber mouse. Kiss me goodnight, Eddie.
A poem by William Butler Yeats with an opening line by Thomas Mann, titled Politics. In our time, the destiny of man presents its meaning in political terms. Thomas Mann. The poem, Politics. How can I, that girl standing there, my attention fix on Roman or on Russian or on Spanish politics? Yet here's a traveled man that knows, and there's a politician that has read and thought, and maybe what they say is true of war and war's alarms. But oh, that I were young again and held her in my arms.
tell you about Texas Radio and the Big Beat. Comes out of the Virginia swamps, cool and slow, with plenty of precision. And a backbeat narrow and hard to master. Some call it heavenly in its brilliance, others mean and rueful of the Western dream. I love the friends I have gathered together in this thin raft. We have constructed pyramids in honor of our escaping. This is the land where the Pharaoh died. Negroes in the forest, brightly feathered, they are saying, forget the night, live with us in forests of azure. Out here in the perimeter, there are no stars. Out here, we is stone, immaculate. Now listen to this, I'll tell you about the heartache. I'll tell you about the heartache and the loss of God. I'll tell you about the hopeless night. About the maiden with wrought iron soul. I tell you this, no eternal reward will forgive us now for wasting the dawn.
And there you have it, episode 216 of Troubadours and Rock on Tours, with yours truly, E.W. Conundrum Demure. I'd like to thank those folks that made this episode possible. First and foremost, writer, editor, professor, and all-around great guy, Robert Mooney, Dr. Robert Mooney. Good luck with the new book and with Etruscan Press. So nice to have you on Troubadours and Rock on Tours. I look forward to talking with you again very soon. I'd also like to thank the good Dr. Michael Pavese, a.k.a. Uncle Cesare, for another wonderful essay. Thank you to William Butler Yeats, as well as these wonderful musical artists. John Lennon, Sister Waves, Lou Reed, Nico Case, The Doors, Branford Marsalis, and Terrence Blanchard, too. Have a wonderful week. Tend to those that you love and to yourself as well. Spring is almost here. Thanks for listening.